Let's go. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight I'd like to begin with you a new series, or it's actually a continuation of a very old series. We've had a few summers when we discussed what we called halachic men. The topic of halachic men is to try to understand the life and times of various poskim, various people who were instrumental in making the halacha what we know of it today. And the first year that we did halachic men, we spoke about the Beis Yosef and the Ramah, all the Shurim up on YU Torah. You could have fun and listen to them again. The second year we did halachic men, we spoke about the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. We did the Shach and the Taz, etc. The third year, we spoke about the Vilna Gaon and the... And then we also did one about the Mishnah Brura and the Chazon Ish. So maybe this is season 5. I don't remember. I thought this was only season 4. Maybe I counted wrong. I don't know what I'm up to. But I realized that A, I wasn't sure what to talk about this summer. B, during the summer, I generally have more time to spend reading and preparing than I have during the year. So I wanted to go back earlier. So this is going to be Halachic Men the earlier. So we're going to talk about Rashi. Now, why start with Rashi? Rashi is obviously not the first halachic man, but why start with Rashi? So in many ways, I would argue that Rashi is the most important figure.
More than the Rambam?
More than the Rambam, yes. More than the Rambam. And I'll tell you why. You see, if you are a Jew, you know something about Rashi. Virtually every Jew who is literate in Jewishness knows Rashi.
Did you say illiterate?
Literate. Every Jew who is literate in matters Jewish knows something about Rashi. Rambam is for the scholars, is for the elite. You could be a really good Jew, and you could not know a single comment of the Rambam. No? The Rambam is an important figure, don't get me wrong. And the Rambam represents a certain value that we as modern Orthodox Jews ascribe to a value of Torah Umada, a value of mastering the world and excelling in every realm of life. And obviously the Rambam is a role model, but Lahavdil and Lamashal, the Rambam might be like a Rav Aaron Lichtenstein type figure. In other words, super duper genius, I can't relate to him, too smart, okay, obviously I value it. It's something that I look towards and I say, oh my gosh, that guy has a PhD from Harvard in English Lit and he knows, like, everything. Amazing, but like, come on. Right? What does the Rambam, and you know what, and statements of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Zichrono Livracha, right, are also the type of statements that average mere mortals like me and like you probably read it, and you have to read the sentence 5 or 6 times to try to begin to figure out what it means. And a lot of Rambam is like that. But Rashi is for everybody. You take a kid, right, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichrono Livracha, used to say that Rashi is written for that 7-year-old child who is beginning to learn Chumash. Everybody... right? Knows. Now, again, I'm not saying this is the best educational technique. It could be that we would benefit by just teaching Chumash as Chumash rather than Chumash and Rashi, right?
Why
would we benefit? Because I think there might be something to be gained by first knowing what the basic storyline is and then seeing what's being added. There might be some, right? We might not appreciate the contribution of Rashi precisely because we grew up with it. Right? And even if we didn't, you know what? And even if we didn't learn Rashi as kids, so much of the way we know Chumash is Chumash with Rashi. It's all together. So Rashi is really, really an important figure. Now, what we will have to try to figure out is the Rashi that we know from Chumash, is he a halachic figure or not? Can I divide between Chumash and Perushim on Chumash and halacha? Even Rashi on Gemara. Is Rashi on Gemara only a commentator? Right? Whereas Rashi and the Gemara in his commentary also giving me halachic statements. We have to figure that out as we'll go on. But that's already coming attractions. Tonight we have to first figure out who was this Rashi dude. That's basically our goal. Hi, Frida.
Just a quick question. Okay, so who is today's Rashi to Rav Lichtenstein?
So I was thinking about that. You know what? I'm not sure. One could argue that Rabbi Steinsaltz is trying to fill that role. Right? Remember, the fact that Random House Art Scroll might be the Rashi of the generation on a certain level. Right? In terms of popularizing Torah. Right? The type of book that anybody could pull off the shelf and read. Right? Again, what's sad about our generation is we might be the first generation that doesn't access the text in the original Hebrew. It's an advantage that we are the first generation where Torah is so widespread. The phenomenon of Daf Yomi is unbelievable. Because what we have is Jews who really have great difficulty learning Gemara on their own and are doing it. And it's an unbelievable thing. You should know, there's a point that Professor Shaul Stempfer made when I took his course years ago. There was never a Yiddish translation of Shas.
Really?
Think about that. Wow. That's profound.
They made them do it in...
That is profound. Yiddish. A toizint yar Yiddish, right? That's what Shiko Fishman said, right? Yiddish has a line in the Machzor Vitri, which are students of Rashi. Right? There's Yiddish lines in the Machzor Vitri. Yiddish is 1,000 years, and there was never a Yiddish translation of Shas. Isn't that interesting? The first language that Shas was translated into completely is English. What does that say about American Jewry? Right? Think about it.
Yeah,
something. It says something. Now, okay, so what we have to figure out tonight, our goal, our agenda is, who is this man, Rashi? We assume that Rashi is a real person. Rashi actually lived. Not only did Rashi actually live, we know when Rashi lived. Wikipedia tells us that Rashi is born, right? His name is Solomon Yitzchaki, or whatever, Solomon of Troyes, born the 22nd of February, 1040, died 13th of July, 1105. Okay, let's go slowly. We know when Rashi died. Rashi died, it's recorded by his students. This was a big event. Biggest figure in the world, 29th day of Tammuz. That's coming up pretty soon, in around the month. 29th day of Tammuz in the year 1105. That's when Rashi died. His students write he was 65 years old. Now, when they say he was 65... Does it mean he was exactly 65? Probably not. Numbers in those days, right, people would approximate. He was about 65. So he was born probably about 1040. 22nd of February, have no idea how they got that one, right? We have no idea how we would know when Rashi was born. People weren't born in those days, or great figures weren't born. He was born as Shloima. As a little kid, right? And he became Rashi later on. It's highly unlikely that anyone would know that his name, that anyone would know his birthday.
But wasn't his father some kind of...
Okay, so was Rashi's father some kind of something? We're going to talk about that in like 4 minutes, in some length. That is one of the topics. His name is Shlomo Yitzchaki. Now, just a few things about Rashi. Before you begin, he dies, he's born in 1040. Now, there is a tradition out there that 1040, the year of Rashi's birth, and this is another reason to push it to 1040, because of the tradition, that the year of Rashi's birth is an important year in Jewish history for two other reasons. One reason, the Maharshal has this in his Tshuvas in Simen Choftes. The Maharshal gives us a little history of Rashi, and the Maharshal writes that the year that Rashi was born is the year that Rabbeinu Gershom Ma'ar HaGola died. Wow. Now, you have to remember, Rabbeinu Gershom is known as Ma'ar HaGola. He is the light of the Golas. He is the biggest figure in Ashkenaz. Ashkenaz in the narrow sense, as in Germany, but also in the broader sense, as in all of the European countries, right? Rabbeinu Gershom is known for his takanos. Ad hayom hazeh, we know Rabbeinu Gershom says, don't marry two women, don't divorce your wife against her will, don't read someone else's mail, right? It's well known about Rabbeinu Gershom. That's who he is. Rabbeinu Gershom is the first major figure outside of, now again, there are some figures who are more minor than him, but outside of Iraq. You have to realize that after Churban Beis HaMikdash, the center of Jewish life is in Iraq. Iraq is where you had the Reish Galusa. We still daven for him every Shabbos. He hasn't been doing well for the last 1,000 years, but okay, we still daven for him. The Reish Galusa in Iraq, by the way, there are two yeshivas in Iraq, Sura and Pumpadisa, no? Pumpadisa is known, from those of you who follow the news, as the hellhole of this planet. It's called Fallujah. You don't want to be there. Now. But at their times, beforehand, we're talking 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th century, this is the center of the intellectual Jewish universe. Right? Comes along Rabbeinu Gershom, and Rabbeinu Gershom in Germany receives traditions coming through Italy, etc., and that begins to establish Germany as the center. He is Rabbeinu Gershom Ma'ar HaGola. He lights up the Golos. Rabbeinu Gershom dies, according to the Maharshal, in 1040. But I got a problem. You know my problem? Avram Grossman. Avram Grossman is a historian that we are going to be talking about a lot, in part because he wrote a book called Rashi. If you want to know what I'm using this summer to prepare, Avram Grossman's book, Rashi. I'm also using books that I just stole from my father on Sunday. These are the older works, Heichal Rashi in 1940. They published a book about Rashi. 1940 is an important year in Rashi, because if Rashi lives 1040 to 1105, so 1940 is 900 years after Rashi is born. I also have over here a book that Mosada Rav Kook put out called Sefer Rashi. It was edited by Rav Maimon. Now, these are the basic works that we have, and much more that we'll be discussing. So now, Avram Grossman has two major works on history. One is called Chachmei Ashkenaz HaKadmonim, the other is called Chachmei Tsarfas HaKadmonim, the earlier sages of Germany and the earlier sages of France. Those are his two basic works. In his work, Chachmei Ashkenaz HaKadmonim, Grossman maintains, Grossman maintains that to attribute Rabbeinu Gershom's death to the year 1040 is probably wrong, because all the manuscript versions that talk about Rabbeinu Gershom's death have him dying in 1028. And the Balei HaTosfos, in the Tosfos in Avodah Zarah, you see, Rabbeinu Gershom was known for establishing the correct text of Shas, or for doing some of the pioneering work in establishing the correct text. The Balei HaTosfos, the Tosav in Ochanan, in Avodah Zarah Chofches, talks about that in the better versions of the Gemara, which were printed before the year 1028, written before 1028, we have this in this text. 1028 seems to be the cutoff. 1028 would seem to be the time that Rabbeinu Gershom died. So one tradition is that Rabbeinu Gershom dies in 1040, and that's the same year that Rashi is born. And that tradition does not seem to have that much to stand on. However, there is another tradition. There's another tradition that the year that Rashi was born, 1040, is an important year for a different reason. 1040 is also the year that Chizkiyah Gaon dies. Chizkiya Gaon is the last Gaon. The last. Now, Reb Hai Gaon is the last well-known Gaon, no? But after Reb Hai, you have a Reb David and a Chizkiya. So there are two people. Chizkiya Gaon, basically in 1038, is kicked out of Sura, goes to Pumbedisa, he's tortured, he's put into prison, in 1040 he's killed, end of the Gaonim. It happens that two of his sons survived and made it to Spain, so the Gaonic line continued. Right? The Gaon is the teacher, the head teacher in Iraq, and is the head of the Jewish people in Galus. So Chizkiya Gaon dies in 1040, and that, again, we have a tradition in Chazal that before the sun sets, the sun rises. Ad shalom shak ashim sho shel Eli, Zarach Shimsho Shel Shmuel. Right? Shmuel comes before Eli is totally out of the picture. Shmuel is already on the scene. Rashi is already on the scene before, again, either Rabbeinu Gershom would make more sense intellectually, but this idea of Chizkiya Gaon also carries some weight. So far, so good? Let's go on. Let's continue discussing why Rashi is important. Now, Grossman points out in his introduction, right? Introduction to Rashi. He points out as follows. Rashi flourishes 11th and 12th century, no? The very beginning of the 12th century, the very and the end of the 11th century, right? 1040 till 1105. Again, 1105, the students of Rashi, we could say, are 12th century figures. Rashi himself is 11th century. Now, what's important at this time? Well, what's important at this time is in the Christian world, there are two things that are happening. One, and the Christian world is the world in Europe. One thing that's going on is there's a rise of cities. Cities had been in decline during the earlier period of the Middle Ages. They had been in decline because the only thing that was really going on in the cities of excitement was that there was a church and there was some teachings going on through the church. But smaller communities and farming is really where the action was. Cities were very small in the days of Charlemagne. Cities are just small. Cities begin to rise, in part because of different trade routes, different commodities becoming more popular in exchange, but cities begin to rise at this time. Point one. Point two. There's something called the 12th century Renaissance. The 12th century Renaissance is not the Renaissance that you've heard of in high school. Right? The 12th century Renaissance is not nearly as exciting. Right? We don't have like frescoes being drawn on like buildings and stuff like that. But the 12th century Renaissance is a move within the church to go back to studying text rather than just studying ideas and values. The Bible had been used until this point to glean ideas, and stories are coming out of the Bible, but the preachers and the church fathers were not talking about the text as text. Suddenly in the 12th century, and the reason why this developed, anyone could speculate as to why, but there comes about a study of text. Now, originally, the study of text is to try to find a link between the text and the stories and the values and the morals that they're bringing out. Later on, the study of text moves to become more of a study of text. Now, if you think about Rashi, and we'll talk about this next time we learn, by the way, next week I have a wedding, so next week we can't have a shiur. 2 weeks from now, God willing, we'll talk about Rashi al HaTorah. When we talk about Rashi al HaTorah, Rashi al HaTorah is trying to take Midrashim and find a link in the text for the Midrash. Rashi's intellectual heirs, primarily his grandson Rashbam, are focused on text as text. If you want to trace this, now again, Grossman knows And any good historian would say this type of thing. You can't assume a link unless you know there's a link. But the very fact that the same type of thing is going on in the Christian world of exegesis and in Mefarshei Tanakh is highly suggestive that perhaps there was some cross-pollination of ideas. Right? I don't know for sure. I do know that there were disputations. I do know that the same type of thing is going on, but do I know that, right, there is a direct cause between these two phenomena? No. But it's likely, because it's going on, same part of the world, same time. Good? Fine. Now, what else do we know about Rashi? The first Hebrew book published is Chumash with, you got it, Rashi. Right? This is very important. Very important. Daniel Bamberg in 1520s published Chumash with Rashi. Okay? Now.
Good question. Back to 1040. Isn't the truth the story about when Rashi's mother was pregnant?
Wait. We'll talk about the stories in a few minutes if we have time tonight. We're going to talk about lots of stories. I like stories. Is there any truth? Probably not. But it's a good story. Okay. Now, what does Rashi stand for? Lots of traditions. It stands for Rabban Shel Yisrael, which, by the way, is the point that we mentioned earlier. Rabban, the teacher of all Jews. Rashi is the teacher par excellence. Now, obviously, it stands for Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. Rabbi Shlomo and the patronym, his father's name, Yitzchak. Okay, there is a tradition out there that Rashi comes from Rabbeinu Shlomo HaYarchi. Yarchi means he came from Lunel. That might mean, even though Wikipedia argues that this is not found in any Jewish sources, but there are some Jewish sources, that Rashi's comes from Yarchi, which means he came from Provence, from southern France. That probably means that his father's family traced its lineage down in southern France. Be it as it may, Rashi is French. He's born in Troyes. He dies in Troyes. Troyes is where? In the Champagne region of France. Morai Rabotai, Champagne is not just a drink. Champagne is a place where that drink where the grapes that make that drink come from, no? Just like sherry only comes from a certain area in Spain, Jerez or whatever it is, right? So also champagne can technically only come from this area. Now,
what language did he speak?
Rashi probably spoke an old French. Not only did Rashi probably speak an old French, one of the best sources for old French is Rashi. If you look in the dictionaries of Rashi, they can also be used, the old French words can be used to go back, like Blondheim or whatever, in his dictionary. This is one of the better sources of old French words. Rashi also probably spoke Hebrew. He wrote Hebrew pretty darn well, but he certainly spoke French. Rashi's mother was the brother of Shimon the Elder, who is a student of Rabbeinu Gershom. Shimon the Elder, Rashi's mother's brother, Rashi's uncle, right, was the author of Piyutim. Now, there is some question. Grossman says it might be a different Shimon the Elder. It might not be the famous one. Who knows? But according to tradition, Rashi's mother also had Gichas. Rashi's father, Shlomo ben Yitzchak. What's the story with Rashi's father? So, was Rashi's father a scholar? Well, it depends who you ask. No? The first Rashi al HaTorah begins here. As you know, I put sources sheets together, and they always do it out of order, right? In Bereshis, the Torah says, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz. At the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So Rashi quotes, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Lo haya tzarech lahatchil ta Torah ela me'achodesh hazeh lachem, shi mitzvah rishonah shenistavu by Yisrael. Right, Torah should really begin from the first mitzvah. How come it begins from Bereishis? So Rashi tells us because it's trying to give us a link, a connection to Eretz Yisrael. Now, if the nations of the world claim that we're robbers and we took the land, we should say, no, it's God's land and God gave it to those who he wanted and therefore we got the land from God. Now, this question is put in Rashi in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak. The tradition was that Rabbi Yitzchak, the author of this question, was Rashi's father. You see, Rashi says, how could I begin my commentary on Chumash without mentioning Daddy? But Daddy didn't really do anything. Daddy isn't really a scholar of any note. So I decided, you know what, Dad, ask me a question, I'll include it from you. So Dad asks a pretty simple question. Why does Torah begin with Bereishis? Right? So Rashi says, oh, Dad asked the question, I'll include it in order to show, right, that Dad was something to give respect to Dad. That is a tradition that the Taz quotes in his book Divrei David, in the next source. The Taz writes, now here in the Kadabin Natalya, we used to Kasav Echad, Yoshan, Noshan, Ma'od, Dio Rashi. When I was young, I saw a very old explanation of Rashi, Kasav Bo, Zehamamar, Vishem Reb Yitzchak, Shemevi Rashi, Eno Muskar, Bishum Midrash, O Talmud, El Shemash Amar, Ba'atam, Pasa Bracious, Hu Midrash, V'lo tivi Reb Yitzchak, Shazer Reb Yitzchak, Kaya Aviv Shal Rashi, V'lo Haya Lamdan, God of Rashi, Yotzel Echabit Aviv, U'lazkir B'tchilas Chibur, V'amalo, Sha'ali Eza She'ela, V'echteben Ashmecha. Basically, that Rashi says, you know, Dad, I want to include you in my book, so ask a question, I'll include you in it. That's the story, because Rashi's father was not a scholar. That's what the tradition goes. Now, there is a little bit of a problem with this tradition. You see, if I call my father, am I allowed to call my father by his name?
Not really.
No! Forget not really. Get rid of that word really.
Okay.
No!
No.
I'm not allowed to call my daddy by his name.
Oh,
right? Now, there's a discussion if you call daddy by the name with a title, right? Is that permitted or not? So maybe Rashi's calling him Rabbi Yitzchak, but it's not so simple that that would be permitted, and it's unlikely that this is really Rashi calling his father, especially because all the Taz says that he couldn't find a midrash that has Rabbi Yitzchak as being, he couldn't find a midrash with Rabbi Yitzchak in it, but we now have the Midrash Tanchuma, the Buber edition, the Midrash Tanchuma, that has this statement in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak. So we know that Rabbi Yitzchak is an authority in the Midrash, not Rashi's father. Point one. Point two. The Taz says, well, Rashi's father is obviously a scholar because I found one place where Rashi's father is quoted by Rashi, and that's in Avodah Zarah Daf Ayin Hey. Ein mol in Shas, only one time in Shas does Rashi quote his father, and it's a girsa issue. The Gemara over there, I give you the Gemara here in Avodah Zarah, right? The Gemara discusses how a person goes about kashering a wine press. Right? If you have a non-Jewish wine press, so the wine of the non-Jews is non-kosher. How do you go about kashering the wine press? It's a discussion. Do you just rinse it off with water? Do you have to use water and ashes? And if you have to use water and ashes, is the order water, ashes, ashes, water? Is the order that you need three or four different parts? There's all discussion in the Gemara. And Rashi has like some girsa issue, some textual issue in this Gemara. And Rashi quotes that I heard one explanation from my father, Lashon Abba Mori Menuchato Kavod, V'unir Be'enai, V'havishon Lashon Mori. Rashi says the first explanation is my teacher's explanation, and the second explanation is my father's explanation, and my father's explanation is correct. Now, it's questionable. Api halacha, are you allowed to say that your father is correct? The Gemara discusses the mitzvah of kibarav, lo yachriya et dvarav. Right? If daddy is arguing with someone else, I shouldn't say dad is right. Right? I shouldn't do that. Right? So maybe you're allowed to do that in this case because his father's not here, because his father's dead already. Maybe that's the issue in Rashi. I don't know. But the Taz says this proves conclusively that Rashi's father was some sort of scholar. Now, when you think about it, does it really prove anything? It means that there's one comment that Rashi had from his father. That's it. Rashi wrote on 2,740 whatever pages of Shas. Quotes his father one time. Rashi wrote on Chumash. Rashi wrote on Navi. Rashi wrote comments on Piyutim. The Aruga Sabosan quotes comments that Rashi wrote on Piyutim. Rashi wrote Piyutim. Rashi wrote certain Slichos. There's Slichos authored by Rashi after 1096, after the First Crusade. Rashi quotes his father one time. Does that prove he's a scholar?
I think that he was involved
in text. Right, he knew some text, right. He was involved in text. Does that mean he was a scholar? I don't know. Not so much, but maybe something. Maybe it proves something about his father. It's not abundantly clear. And we see, though, that the Taz is telling us two different traditions. One tradition is that Rashi's father is not a scholar, and therefore Rashi's father is said, ask a question, and the first Rashi in Chumash says, I'm Rabbi Yitzchak's daddy. The other tradition, no. Rashi's father really was a scholar. Hard to know. It's hard to know, but I would be inclined that it's not so likely that he was really a scholar just because there's only one quote from him. And I'll say better. In this book that Mosada Rav Kook put out in the 1960s, so Avraham Berliner wrote an article, a very lengthy article, about Rashi, Le Toldot Perushei Rashi. On page 150 in Berliner's article, and this is quoted by Grossman in his book Chachmei Tzarfas HaRishonim, footnote number 6. Rashi, Berliner in his book on Rashi, in his essay in this book on Rashi, Berliner points out that if you look in the manuscripts of Avodah Zarah 75a, you do not see, in the manuscript versions of Rashi and Shas, you do not see this quoting his father. So the one quote from Rashi's father might not even exist. Oh my gosh. Now, whose quote is this? It might be the Rashbam, it might be the grandson who's quoting his own father, Rabbeinu Meir, who was Rashi's son-in-law, who was known for being a scholar. Right? So it could be that this father that's being quoted is not really Rashi's father. Now, Danny Franco asked a few minutes ago about the legends relating to Rashi. So let's talk about the legends relating to Rashi, just very briefly, because it will connect to this idea also, so whether Rashi's father is a scholar or not a scholar, etc. I should point out, by the way, that the best article on the legends surrounding Rashi is written by Dr. David Berger's father. Professor Yeshayahu Berger has an article in a volume called Rashi, His Teachings and Personality, Essays on the Occasion of the 850th Anniversary of His Death, edited by Dr. Simon Federbusch, published by Cultural Department of the World Jewish Congress in 1958. So Yeshayahu Berger has an article called Rashi Ba'agadat Ta'am. And he quotes a bunch of stories about Rashi. Almost all these stories about Rashi, by the way, are found in this book, the Hichal Rashi, right? There are lots of stories about Rashi. What are some of the stories about Rashi? So some of the stories about Rashi go as follows. That Rashi's father, according to one tradition, was a scholar. And Rashi's father, though, was very, very poor. And he wasn't able to make ends meet, and they had like no food for Shabbos. And then one day, he goes and he finds a gemstone. And he wants to find out how much this gemstone is worth. So he goes to somebody, and the person tells him, oh, it's worth so much money, you're going to be fine. By the way, you should know that the bishop is looking for exactly this stone for his crown, and he's going to pay tons of money for this. Rashi's father is a religious man, a devout individual. He doesn't want to sell this stone to the bishop. He takes it, he throws it into the ocean. Quite another tradition, the bishop hears about this, comes to Rashi's father asking for the stone. Rashi's father like makes a fake trip and drops the stone into the sea. Gone. A baskol comes out from heaven and says, you are going to have an even greater gem. Your wife will give birth to a child who will be the greatest gem, and that child is Rashi. By the way, Rashi's parents were married for at least 10 years and did not have children. in halacha, when you're married for 10 years, you don't have children, that's considered like a bad sign. And then they have this child. So that's one tradition. Now, according to this tradition, Rashi's father is somewhat of a scholar. In other manuscripts of this tradition, in the Shalshalat HaKabbalah, which is like a different version of stories, and in manuscripts from Taiman, from Yemen. By the way, it's interesting to note how far and wide the stories of Rashi spread. In Yemen, there are manuscripts telling the Nisim and the Flois of Rashi. Unbelievable, Nisim and the Flaot, right? But in Yemen. So in Yemen, they tell a story that Rashi's father was not a scholar, but he was a very devout man, and he had a very long beard. And to show his religiosity, he would use his long beard to brush off the dust on the Torah scrolls. On the covers of the Torah, it would get dirty occasionally. He would use his beard to brush it off. And this itself was such a zechus, such a wonderful thing, such a frumkeit, and that's why they had a child, Rashi. And there are other, now, when we talk about, by the way, the stories of Rashi, I should point out that in this book, the Heichal Rashi, which is written by Yitzchak Avi Ezri, right, in this book, by Yitzchak Avineri in the Heichal Rashi, so he points out that Leopold Zuntz, in his articles on Agadot, on these stories, says that he doesn't believe any of them, and you have to assume that these stories are just make-believe, and they might really be make-believe. But nonetheless, what these stories reflect, and this is what Yitzchak Avineri points out, they reflect how deeply the legends of Rashi were embedded among the Jewish people. There are stories of Rashi going back hundreds and hundreds of years, and they're being retold. And that tells us something not only about Rashi, but something about the values that these communities respected. If in Taiman, the story of Rashi's father is that he's a devout person who uses his beard to clean off the Torah, rather than the story of how Rashi's father is a scholar, that shows you what they valued in Taiman. No? You can figure out a community's values based on the stories that they tell. Next story. Rashi's mother is like 9 months. She's an extra innings of her pregnancy. She's like 9+ months of pregnancy, and there are different versions of the story. One version of the story is that suddenly a group of like horses begins to like run down the street as she is walking to shul to daven ma'ariv. She's got, right? By the way, in terms of what a community respects, Rashi's mother, 9+ months pregnant, walking to shul to daven ma'ariv. She went to Mount Sinai, I guess. And horses come down and they're about to trample her, and she gets pushed against the wall, and suddenly a neis min hashamayim is that the wall gets indented, and she's saved. And people tell the story. Rav Maimon writes that when he was in Worms, he saw the indentation in the wall, and everyone said, this indentation, that's from Rashi's mother's stomach. That's the story over there. Now, the other version of the story that involved that Rashi's mother had some priest who was chepping her, etc., who wanted to punish her, and he like started to drive and attack her. Whatever it is. Interesting story about the godless of Rashi's mother going to daven ma'ariv, etc. A little bit of a problem with this story. That story is in Worms. Rashi is born in Troy. Different town. It ain't Worms. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. But one thing I do know is that Ad Hayom Hazeh in Worms, they claim credit for Rashi. Because there's a little room in Worms that they call the Beis Medrash of Rashi. You can go and see it, Ad Hayom Hazeh. And there's a chair there. That's called Rashi's chair. Now, Rashi spent some time in Worms. Rashi, who was born in Troyes, goes to study in Germany. He learns by a Reb Yaakov ben Yakar in Mainz. And then when Reb Yaakov ben Yakar dies in Mainz, his successor is not intellectual enough for Rashi. So Rashi goes to Worms to study. Rashi had his children. Rashi only had daughters. Right? 3 or 4 of them. Unclear how many. We know the names of 2 of them, Yocheved and Miriam. We don't know, by the way, the name of Rashi's wife. Although, according to one legend, her name was Rivka. Right? But we don't really know the name of Rashi's wife. In one legend in Avineri's book is that her name was Rivka. We don't... Is that fair to say we don't know the name of Rashi's wife? Right? I know what Frida's thinking. Right? Right, not to be, we don't know, that's correct. But, I mean, it is suggestive, it's interesting. But listen to this one. So, Rashi's in Worms to study some Torah. Worms has always taken some credit for Rashi, that to this very day, now again, the tradition that the story of his mother happened in Worms says that right after the baby is born, they run back to Troyes. Right, with this little baby. Maybe, I don't know. Last point, two more points to talk about. The legends of Rashi's daughters, right, is that these are unbelievable young women. We do know from certain manuscripts that they say at the end of Rashi's life, Rashi had difficulty writing, and he would dictate proudly to his daughter who wrote some of his tshuvot and things. So that we do know. So she was one of his daughters, at least, not sure which one, was somewhat educated. There are traditions out there that have no basis whatsoever that Rashi's daughters were tefillin. There's no basis to those traditions.
But they're there.
But they are there, like all of these traditions. That's right.
Including the one about the indentation in the wall.
Right. It's there. But I don't know what it means.
Do they tell stories like this about you?
No, exactly.
So,
right? So it's something. It is something. Last point to mention. What did Rashi do for a living?
Winemaker.
Any votes for anything other than winemaker? Scribe. Maybe. Possibly. So let me refer you to Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik's article called Halachic Text. Can Halachic Text Talk History? In AJS Review, Volume 3, 1978. Footnote 54. Dr. Soloveitchik, and this became like a very famous footnote. Dr. Soloveitchik writes that many assume that Rashi was a vintner. That means winemaker, for the Philistines among us. That Rashi is a vintner. And he quotes a few tshuvot that say something that might imply that Rashi is a vintner. But then Dr. Soloveitchik says either if you look at the manuscripts of these tshuvot or if you read them carefully, it doesn't say that Rashi was a winemaker. Right? It means that Rashi knew something about winemaking, he was exposed to winemakers, but not that Rashi is a winemaker. No evidence whatsoever that Rashi is a winemaker. The passage that is used most often probably refers to Reb Yitzchak Reb Yehuda, who's one of Rashi's teachers, rather than to Rashi himself. Okay, so now, Dr. Soloveitchik, undoubtedly, right, Dr. Soloveitchik argues, here, the presumption is against anyone being a wine grower in Troyes. Its chalky soil, to this day, is inhospitable to viticulture. Not surprisingly, Elizabeth Shapin has found no references to vines in local documents in Troyes. In a book called Les Villes des Fours de Champagne des Origines au début du whatever, whatever, whatever. Right? Now, that means that Rashi is probably not a winemaker because Troyes is not winemaking. Now, they probably had some small vines. People in those times, one of Dr. Soloveitchik's major theories is that people in that time drank a lot more wine than we drink. We drink water. We drink Coca-Cola, bad for us. We drink orange juice. They didn't have these things. Water was not clean. Right? They drank a ton of wine. Now, the people probably made local wine, but to export wine for a distance, you needed a better wine, and the wine that came from Troyes was not exported. Rashi, says Dr. Soloveitchik, is probably not a winemaker. There were some local vines, probably for private use. Rashi's own words imply as such, but they should not have regularly produced a surplus sufficient to afford a living in asking, but again, that they should have produced a surplus sufficient to afford a living is asking a great deal of them. Despite all this, Rashi nevertheless may have been a vintner, but by the same measure, he may have been an egg salesman. This is the end of Dr. Soloveitchik's footnote. So now, There is a fellow named Meir I. Gruber, who Meir Gruber is a professor in the Department of Bible Archaeology in Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Meir Gruber wrote an article on the Sefarim blog in 2007. Meir Gruber's article decides to take Dr. Soloveitchik seriously, like in his own humorous way. Was Rashi actually an egg salesman? Well, he tries to prove from lots of tshuvot of Rashi that Rashi likes eggs. Rashi writes in one place, "I eat eggs in the morning." Whoopee. I also eat eggs in the morning. I'm not an egg salesman. I don't know what that means. Right? Then he proves, well, okay, yeah, Rashi had some exposure to eggs. He also had exposure to cows and to sheep, etc. Cows and sheep, etc. Then he goes on and he says, you know how Rashi earned a living? You see, everyone's bothered. How did Rashi earn a living? So Avram Grossman contends that Rashi was a merchant. He sold stuff to Goyim. And there is like one tshuva of Rashi that discusses that a guy owed him money and Rashi wanted the guy to swear. And the question is the guy swearing in church, etc., etc., etc. So there's some discussion. Does it prove he's a merchant? I don't know. Is Rashi a vintner? I don't know. Says Meir Gruber. One second, let me just finish this point, then we'll take your question. Okay. Says Meir Gruber, you know what Rashi was? He was a Rosh Yeshiva. He was a teacher. Rashi built a school in Troyes, and people came to study with him. And you know what? They paid him. And then Gruber adds something which is interesting. He says, maybe this entire effort to try to figure out what profession Rashi has comes from a perspective that it's more respectable to be a working person who studies Torah rather than being a teacher of Torah. And if we know that Rashi's a teacher of Torah, yes, Rashi has a Gaon. He quotes from different tshuvot of Rashi. Rashi signs himself as Gaon. Gaon means an official teacher. That's what Gaon meant. If Rashi's a teacher, and that's how he earned his living, again, we have no documentation that Rashi earned his living from it. But if it does, that would change our perspective, and then maybe we should respect the teachers more, because even the great Rashi was a teacher for a living. Comment.
I would tend to agree with that, because if you say that he's a merchant, doesn't he know the first page of the Zohar that you're not supposed to...
Rashi deals with that in his Truvas, how to get around that issue in terms of like doing business with Goyim and like having them swear, etc. Yeah, of course Rashi knew the first page of the Avodah Zarah. He wrote commentary on it.
So I'm saying if he knew the first page, then how could he be...
So sometimes things happen and sometimes, etc. So we have to deal with these issues. Now, there are other traditions, by the way, about Rashi that we're not speaking about in Yeshayo Berger's article about Rashi. There's traditions that Rashi went into exile, that he wrote his book, he was around 25, he didn't want to publish it yet, he went traveling through Europe, and he was anonymous, and then people found out who he was, etc. Lots of stories about that. There are many stories of many Gedolei Yisrael who went into exile, including the Vilna Gaon. A lot of these stories of Rashi, by the way, are quite similar to stories of the Gra in that book Aliyos Aliyo that published in 1856. The fact is that we have a way, probably for worse, not for better, of trying to homogenize Gedolei Yisrael and trying to tell stories that make everyone sound largely the same. And one of the good reasons to study history is to try to figure out some local color and local flavor, but the traditions should not be laughed at. These stories that people say about Rashi and about his mother and about his father, you know what, even if they're not factually accurate, but like you said a few minutes ago, they don't say them about me and you. And there is a value to that. So these are some of the points I wanted to make about Rashi. There's so much more to say. Thank you for listening. Have a good night.